Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along. Fred and Lutz are good supporters of the Sydney Institute, and we very much appreciate the hospitality tonight and on other occasions. Now, tonight we're talking on the subject Reputation Matters. It relates to the book by Peter Keel and Norman Lucas, Reputation Matters, which is published by CCH. So Peter's going to lead off and followed by Norman. I'll introduce them both briefly. Peter Keel is a partner in Clayton Utz in the Dispute Resolution Group. He's an accredited mediator and has lectured in defamation law at the University of New South Wales. And Norman Lucas is also a partner in Clayton Utz in the Dispute Resolution Group, and he has also lectured in defamation at the University of New South Wales. So they're very well qualified to talk about the topic Reputation Matters. And the book is, the full title of the book is A Legal Guide to Risk Management and Corporate Communications. Peter, you're very welcome. And then we'll follow with Norman, and then we'll go to questions and discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Jared. Thanks, Jared. Is this volume okay?
Yeah.
Reputation management has become an industry. The recent coverage of the Visy cartel issue and the involvement of Mr. Pratt, I think, make the point. Michael Pascoe wrote that the letter to customers by Mr. Pratt and Visy, and the Visy defence, and it's worth reading this, come at the price of any hope of repairing reputational damage. But maybe it's too late for that anyway. Reputation has gone the way of scheming lawyers and spin doctors. I'm a lawyer, and you can euphemise all you like, but I think Mr. Pascoe makes a very good point. Reputation is precious, and people and corporations are investing now like never before to protect it. Why particularly now? I think that's worth exploring. I think there are a couple of very serious reasons. First, research by Dr. Dennis Muller from Melbourne University shows that many people do not trust or believe journalists. Dr. Muller isn't alone. Recent Morgan polling shows similar results. Second, there's been a general erosion of remedies available to those who've suffered a damaging headline, and there have been concerns expressed widely about the accountability of the press. I think it's in that environment that this industry has evolved. Now, I'd like to talk about those issues for a few minutes, and Norman will have a look at some of the other consequences, particularly in light of the present debate over privacy. Back in August 2005, there was a media report program on Radio National which looked at Dr. Muller's results. Dr. Muller interviewed members of the public and journalists. What was interesting about his research was the disconnect between what the public, the general public, thought was acceptable behaviour and what journalists thought was acceptable behaviour. One of the questions was whether or not it was all right for someone to take a picture of someone in their backyard, from outside the backyard, mind you, without that person's knowledge or consent. So was it all right to take the picture? I mean, what do you think?
No?
Interestingly, less than 1 out of 10 people thought it was all right to take the photo. 6 out of 10 journalists would have taken it. Is it all right for a journalist to interview a person for a story without saying they're a journalist? Paraphrasing, perhaps, but is it okay to lie? What do you think about that?
No.
Nearly 9 people out of 10, 87%, thought it was never all right. 38% of journalists agreed, or putting it perhaps the other way around, and perhaps a bit more extremely, More than 6 out of 10 journalists thought it was okay to lie, at least sometimes. I don't know if any of you have any kids. I do. I have an 8-year-old. And I think it's important that she gets the message. You don't lie. Is that naive? Of course there are shades of grey. But in the research, there were many examples of this sort of disparity of view. But what we're talking about here is research of the general public. What the man in the street thinks. More than 7 out of 10 members of the general public thought that journalists write stories that they think will be best for sales and ratings, even if it means exaggerating the truth. Now, look, leaving aside, you know, toe-sucking princesses and drug-addled celebrities, can one imagine an occasion where an exaggerated story or an invasive photograph may be appropriate? What justifies departure from the truth? We live in a society which holds the presumption of innocence to be important. You're innocent until proven guilty. And a society where I think most people disapprove of trial by media or trial by schlock jock. But what I ask you to take from what I've just said, and please, for journalists among you, don't shoot the messenger. What I'd ask you to take is that a significant segment of the general population disapproves of tactics sometimes adopted by the press. Most are at least wary. So it's not surprising that people with those sorts of views are concerned to do whatever they can to protect their reputations. That brings me to the second proposition I've put as to why there's been a growth in the reputation management industry: the erosion or unavailability of remedies. What can be done? What can be done if the press get it wrong? Well, there's a tension here, isn't there? But let's not confuse freedom of speech with freedom of the press. Freedom of speech is something we all enjoy, all of us. All of us have the right to express our view. As individuals within a democratic society, we enjoy that right. That's not the same as freedom of the press, the right to report freely and express opinion. Of course we need a free, independent and courageous press. Of course we do. But 59% of the journalists who were surveyed, according to Dr. Mueller, think that they are generally not independent of rich and powerful source forces. In other words, 6 out of 10 journalists think that they are not free and independent. Sometimes without even thinking, we champion the importance of freedom of the press and the public's right to know. Of course we do. But on the other hand, most of us, I think, would agree that our reputation is important and press accountability is important if it is got wrong. In the research I spoke about earlier, nearly 8 out of 10 journalists thought that someone whose reputation was damaged was entitled to both an apology and to compensation if the journalist acted without proper care. So most journalists agree that when the media get it wrong, the error should be fixed. So plainly, freedom of the press doesn't equate to immunity from suit. Most journalists agree that freedom of the press does not mean you can't be sued or can't be held accountable. What's accountable? You remember in the late 80s, early 90s, I'm not sure of the date, Sir Elton John sued the Sun newspaper. The Sun had said that he had approached a rent boy for sex. It was fabrication. Total fabrication. He was awarded £1 million, which he gave to charity. Now that's accountability. How's the press accountable here? What can be done if I'm the subject of a story that trashes my reputation? What would Kate McCann do here if there were a headline, "Mother Fakes Tears Over Child's Disappearance"? there are a few avenues open to an individual. There are not so many for a corporation. Let's look at what the law offers. There have been recent changes to the law of defamation. Companies can no longer sue for defamation. Why? Well, not because they don't have reputations that can be injured. They plainly do. But for a number of other reasons. There was the perception that corporations would use the courts, would use their power to stifle adverse comment. McDonald's is often given as the example. You'll probably all know about that case. You'll remember that McDonald's sued two protesters, members of a group I think called London Greenpeace, which wasn't the other Greenpeace, who distributed pamphlets accusing McDonald's of exploiting its workers and selling unhealthy food, among other things. Since the court found that some of the allegations were untrue, McDonald's won. But the court still found that some of the allegations were true. The trial ran for years. It is said to have cost McDonald's £10 million. And there's now a website, which I think is called McLibel, which is an anti-McDonald's website, and gets a million hits a month. Did McDonald's sue to stop the protests? I don't know. But even if it did, taking away the right to sue from other corporations whose reputation has been trashed seems pretty extreme. I'm not saying let corporations use their size to stifle free speech. Far from it. But I am saying that there may well be better ways to prevent that sort of abuse. Another reason for taking away the right to sue for companies was that they're big enough to look after themselves. How? Issue a press release? How can they guarantee that it will be published? And it certainly won't be published by the arm of the media that defamed him in the first place. Put something on a website? Sure. But there's no guarantee that that will get the same readership. Very few, if any, corporations have the ability to get a message out to the readership or audience as effectively as the major media players, either quickly or at all, and certainly not cheaply. So what about an individual? Well, individuals can sue for defamation. It's an expensive process, and it's a long one. If you complain about a story or a TV program in which you're defamed, the media outlet has 28 days to consider that complaint and to publish an apology. That'll be a long 28 days for you if you complain. The rationale for that is that a reasonable apology given promptly can mitigate the damage and probably prevent litigation. That's all certainly true. We don't know what yet constitutes a reasonable apology, but someone whose reputation has been trashed may well have to wait those 28 days while the publisher considers its position. Now, if you do sue and you win, you might recover up to $250,000. That's a maximum. But even if you succeed, the court has no power to order an apology. So it's of limited benefit. The other big change, I think, is that the defence of truth has changed. Now you can publish anything you want, provided it's true. Think about that. You can publish anything you want, provided it's true. It used to be, in New South Wales at least, that this was tempered by a requirement that what was published was in the public interest. Let me give you a fairly dramatic example. There was a case where what was published of a very high-profile cricketer in the Melbourne Truth was some pretty salacious detail of his sex life. It appeared in the Truth, unsurprisingly, as well. Now, in Victoria, it was enough that what was published was true. That's what the law now is. Now, a current affair wanted to publish the same material in New South Wales. A sportsman got wind of it and asked the court to prevent the story from going ahead. The court agreed and stopped the broadcast, saying that it was not in the public interest that the sportsman's private life was published on national television. The sportsman didn't hold himself out to be a saint, but his private life was his. It was a private matter. He wouldn't succeed anymore because it was true. So that's where the law is. What about government bodies and complaints procedures? The Australian Press Council is the sort of self-regulatory body of the media. It's funded by the newspaper and magazine industries. It has no enforcement or punitive powers. And if you complain, you have to forego your legal rights. Now, many journalists are members of the Australian Journalists Association. It has disciplinary powers for use against journalists who breach the code of its codes of ethics. And various sectors of the broadcasting industry, free-to-air radio, free-to-air TV, have developed their own codes of practice. None of these bodies can compel an apology. None of these bodies can order a payment of compensation. So at least as far as the individual or corporation, which may be aggrieved, are concerned, they can't do much. Where does it all leave us if you're defamed? Well, unless you're a corporation, you can sue. Provided what has been said is not true, and you're not given a reasonable apology within 28 days. You can complain to regulatory bodies, but that won't get you an apology, nor will it get you compensation. This is what I mean by the erosion of remedies. Where does it bring us? Dr. Muller writes, if journalists do not believe themselves to be independent, and if this perception is shared by the public they serve, media credibility is at a dangerously low ebb. I've tried to explain why we think that the reputation management industry is alive and well. Look at the environment. People do not trust or believe the media. People believe the media lie. People disapprove of some media tactics, and a significant number of the media think it's okay to lie. And there's diminishing accountability from the law and from the regulatory regimes that are in place. It's not a great leap to assume that people are concerned to look after their reputations as far as they're able. What else can organisations and individuals do? If reputation is at risk, then prevention is better than cure. That's why we think the industry's evolved. We think there'll be other consequences, and I'll ask Norman to talk about that. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. AFL star Ben Cousins is flying to LA for drug rehab. Kevin Rudd's had a problem with his heart, and Shane Warne's sending another text message. These are all matters that have recently been reported by the media. Now, do most of us find them of interest? You probably do. So do I. Are they, however, truly matters of public interest? Should the media be able to publish stories about such matters, or are some things intrinsically private? It's an important question because media reporting about such matters obviously affects the reputation of those at the centre of the reports. Tonight, I will briefly talk about whether or not an individual might be able to protect his or her reputation by asserting a right to privacy. Currently, there is no right to privacy in Australia. The Constitution gives us no such right. There is no legislation giving us any such right. At best, we have a number of judges in a wide variety of courts suggesting that a right to privacy might now be appropriate. However, despite what this handful of judges has said, no lawyer would say with any conviction that today there is a general right to privacy in this country. Peter and I believe that this situation will change in Australia in the next couple of years, and I'll explain why shortly. However, before I do, the debate about a right to privacy tends to centre on two fundamental questions. First, should there be a right to privacy at all? And second, if so, who is responsible for bringing it in? The politicians or the courts? So first, should we have a right to privacy at all? Well, the answer to that question will depend upon who you ask. I suspect most in the media would say no, or if there is to be such a right, that it should be strictly confined. In fairness, some in the media, such as the Press Council, are prepared to address the question with a degree of objectivity. But for most in the media, unfortunately, that concession isn't made. A privacy right has been described by the media as a crazy plan aimed at encouraging people to sue each other. Of course, one of the ironies about the debate about a right to privacy is that it can be difficult for those who support such a right, or at least advocate that we should debate whether such a right should exist, to get their message across. To do so, one needs the media to actually publish your message. And media's self-interest in the issue can prevent that from occurring. Much of the resistance to a right to privacy involves hiding behind concepts such as freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and the public's right to know. Well, we all love freedom, so I agree that, as Peter said, freedom of the press sounds like a democratic right that's worth fighting for. However, if the lead article in tomorrow's Herald was a story about your struggle with depression or your struggle with gambling, then suddenly freedom of the press doesn't look quite so attractive. The point is this: no freedom is absolute. With rights like freedom of speech and freedom of the press must also come obligations and accountability. Thus, in our view, it is no answer to the possible development of a right to privacy to say it's an attack on freedom of the press and the public's right to know. The second fundamental question was this: if a right to privacy is to develop, how should it be introduced? Through the judges or through politicians? A statutory right to privacy, that is, by introducing legislation, requires the government of the day to pass a law that will curb the media. Immediately, politicians are placed in a position of conflict. I suspect many politicians on a personal level might want a right to privacy, as they may benefit from it. It might prevent a story about their private lives, unconnected with their public functions or duties, from being the subject of media reporting. However, if the Prime Minister, whoever that might be in a couple of weeks, tries to introduce a law curbing the media, he plainly does so at his peril. His government will be pilloried by the media that they are trying to curb. They would also need to depend upon that media to get across their proposals and their rationale for those proposals. Would that really happen? Thus, whilst legislation might produce greater certainty in this area and be preferable to judge-made law, in practice, politicians may find it easier to leave it to the judges. Against that backdrop, I wish to turn to the two factors which, in our view, will hasten the development of a right to privacy. First, the fact that the defence of truth in a defamation action no longer requires the proof of public interest. As Peter said, one of the changes made in 2006 to defamation law was to say that the media now only needs to establish that a story is substantially true. No longer is it necessary to show that the story is also on a matter of public interest. The need for material, even if true, to also be in the public interest provided a constraint on what could be reported. As the media now only needs to establish that what they have said is substantially true, it must be an implicit invitation to report on matters that are private. If the media oversteps the mark and reports purely sensational gossip, we believe the courts will intervene by developing the tort of privacy. The second factor are advances in technology, and these technological advances permit the media to pry into our private lives. By technology, I mean two things: the surveillance equipment, which permits the media to more readily obtain information surreptitiously, and secondly, advances in technology in how that material is then conveyed to readers or viewers. Obviously, the internet is the best example of that. Technology has advanced rapidly in the last 10 or so years. Of course, hidden cameras and eavesdropping equipment have been around for a while. However, they are now more compact and lightweight than ever. Surveillance equipment, which is more compact, can be used with greater ease in a variety of situations. But that smaller equipment has also become far more effective and powerful. The smaller bugs can nonetheless hear more clearly and from a greater distance. The compact hidden camera today has a better picture quality than ever. So the media have greater access to devices to look into our lives. But perhaps, on one view of even greater concern, is that now just about every person in the street also has access to technology to capture events that they see around them. That information can then be either posted on YouTube or sold to a media outlet. The proliferation of camera phones is one example. There was a time when the only people who walked around holding a camera were photographers or perhaps Japanese tourists. Now just about everybody under the age of 40 or 50 has a mobile telephone with a camera on it. Someone takes a photo on their camera phone of a celebrity behaving badly or doing something embarrassing, and it appears that evening on YouTube. So for those two reasons, we believe that a right to privacy will develop. However, defining the limits of that right will not be easy. Any right to privacy developed by the courts has to find the right balance between, on the one hand, protecting individual reputation and privacy, and on the other hand, allowing some appropriate public disclosure. I'd like to examine that balancing act in the context of the taking of some photographs. Two considerations that may be relevant to striking the right balance are these. One, the place in which those photographs are taken. Namely, is it a public or a private place? And second, the identity or the status of the person photographed. Let's turn first to the place in which the photographs have been taken. Where would you draw the line in the following examples? If you see Brad Pitt walking down George Street, presumably it's okay to take his photograph. After all, it's a public street. But what if Brad Pitt is walking down George Street and he's being attacked by an assailant with a knife, or he's having a heart attack? If you took a photo of that, would that invade his privacy? What if Brad Pitt isn't walking down George Street, but is sitting in a hotel foyer or a coffee shop just off George Street? Is that a public place? What if he's standing on the balcony of his home and you can see him from the balcony of your home? What if you hide in the bushes at night outside his bedroom window taking photos? Which would be an invasion of privacy and which would not? The second issue after the place the photos are taken is the extent to which the status or the identity of the person photographed is relevant. In effect, are public figures to be treated differently? True it is that one's more likely to find an invasion of privacy where the person is not a public figure. A person who lives an ordinary private life presumably has a right to go about the private aspects of their life and to be left alone without being subjected to unwarranted publicity. But we do not think it follows that any person who is a public figure is therefore fair game. This is partly because the generic term public figure in fact embraces a diverse range of individuals. People become so-called public figures in many different ways. Consider Jack Nicholson, the actor, Peter Costello, the politician, and Stuart Diver, the Thredbo landslide survivor. Each is arguably a public figure. However, their fame has arisen in quite different ways. Jack Nicholson through achievement, Costello by being elected to a public office, and in the case of Stuart Diver, really by chance and being thrust into the limelight. Do different kinds of fame warrant different levels of loss of privacy? So might not it be the case that Kevin Rudd's heart problem is relevant to the extent it bears upon his fitness for public office? But are the drink driving charges laid against the son of Steve Brax really a public matter? A political candidate professes to put family first, but then appears in some compromising photos on a website. He has arguably forfeited his right to personal privacy by reason of the moral position that he very publicly espouses. But does it follow that every politician's private life is fodder for the media? Probably not. So to conclude, within the next few years, we believe a general right to privacy will be recognised in this country. That may be as a consequence of Parliament bringing in laws, giving a statutory right to privacy, but probably not. The fear of making a courageous decision which upsets the media proprietors is likely to prove too great. Instead, judges, we think, will develop the right to privacy. Ironically, how quickly that occurs is largely in the hands of the media. Armed with a firm belief in the public's right to know, compact and powerful surveillance technology, and relieved of the obligation to show that what they are reporting on is in the public interest, the temptations may prove irresistible. I want to be clear, I don't wish to be misunderstood. When the power of the media is focused on real news, it fulfills a very important function. For example, investigative journalism led to AWB, to the Fitzgerald Inquiry, and similar matters. Unfortunately, such reporting is the exception rather than the rule. Will the desire for ratings and circulation prove too tempting? Will gossip, voyeurism, and other light entertainment triumph over serious journalism, which seeks to bring accountability where it is actually needed? If so, we suspect the courts will not hesitate to say the public does not have a right to know everything. There are limits. Privacy must be respected. In other words, that reputation matters. Thank you.
So thanks to our two speakers, Peter Keel and Norman Lucas. Copies of Reputation Matters is published by CCH is in the room over there, and I'm sure our authors would be happy to sign a copy. It's a terrific reference book and easily understandable by people who are not specialists in defamation or reputation law. So that's for later. And also thanks to Clayton Lutz for their hospitality tonight. Many of our regulars are here, but for those who are not, we don't have fine wines and fine food every night, but who knows what might happen sometime in the future. So now we come to questions and discussion. Of course, we end no later than 7 p.m. and as usual, we're not running a press conference where there are questions here for our associate members. And I should also say we're obviously not taking any questions on matters that are currently before courts. So can I just start off, can I just ask you, Norman, you're talking about the view that a right to privacy will develop, whether it's through legislation or whether it's through law, judge-made law. But if that, I mean, assume for a moment that is the case, how would it be enforced? I mean, it can only be enforced presumably against the established media. You couldn't enforce that against the new media, could you? So you folks are going to sit there, then, okay?
Mm.
Okay, that's fine. All right.
Is that fine? Can
yep.
Anyone
yes. Yep.
No, it could be enforced against not just the established media. In fact, one of the cases that let me go back a step. In 2001, the High Court said, "Let's open the door to the possibility of a tort for invasion of privacy." One of the cases that has followed is, in fact, a non-media case. It's not a new media case, it's actually a stalking case. But whilst it's true that what we've discussed tonight is predominantly looking at it in the context of the media, and the reason for that is we think that's most likely where this issue is going to arise. But nonetheless, as that case grows and further shows, the principles would be applicable to relationships between individuals. That was actually a breakdown of a de facto relationship. And it would also be applicable to new media.
But how about to enforce it against new media?
Enforce it in what sense?
Well, how would you stop something going up on YouTube?
You'd have the same difficulty in a sense with trying to injunct something against a newspaper or a radio. Probably what you would be able to do is get an injunction to actually have it removed. You would probably have difficulty actually restraining it in the sense of getting it put up, because you probably wouldn't know it there until it's up. What you do is rush off to court and try and get a mandatory injunction to actually have it removed, so that at least the number of people who actually see it is minimised.
So, question here. Oh, I have a hey, Jack.
Can I just follow up on Jared's question then about new media? What if someone is posted on YouTube but not in Australia? It's posted on YouTube site somewhere else and you still tap into it. How are your law going to affect that?
Unfortunately, they're probably not going to be able to. Because it's very difficult for a court here in Australia to have any rights enforcement. In relation to anything that occurs outside this country.
So I could then email a naughty picture of somebody doing something rude or to a friend in New York and they could put it up on YouTube, and then that would just be one way of getting around your law.
Well, it would. Like, I guess the legal aspect is you'd actually have to go and commence proceedings in New York or somewhere like that. Probably very difficult to do that. But it would be virtually impossible, I suspect, to get an order from the court here in New South Wales or anywhere else in Australia. Something that's going on in New York, it's prohibited. You could probably get the order, and the capacity to enforce it would be negligible.
Question here, yes.
I've got a very general, maybe a generic question.
all the problems you have been talking about are well known. They have been dissected over and over again. Now, we have literally thousands of publications based on research on how to solve the problems you were talking about. Yet, the problems for evil, part of this evil, I suppose, still exists. So my question is there a basic human nature or factor involved that desires nothing but entertainment and excitement? If that is the case, what eventually can be done about it?
Hang on, stop. Gossip is the...
Have we got too much of an appetite for gossip, and should we do something about that? What can first, chicken or the egg? Do we buy the gossip because it's there, or is it there because we want it? I don't know the answer to that. The question for us really is if whether or not as individuals we have a fundamental right to privacy. Is there a part of our life which we want to protect from prying eyes and which we have an entitlement to protect? And that's what this debate, I think, is about.
There's a question over there. Yep.
Yesterday, or the day before, I'm not touched with the time at the moment. Ari Moss hands down that the poor old Australian votes in Rome. Have the media saying that there's too much secrecy and too much protection, so called privacy. I mean, isn't this only a result of the fact that the media are now so voracious and so hungry for every,
Irene Moss was commissioned to prepare a report by the Australia's Rights Coalition. I haven't read the report, so 365 pages. Could you prepare the report to go through the chairman of the commission, which is called findings? And she quite rightly says that there are a lot of FOI applications, there are a lot of suppression orders, and there's a lot of legislation which limits media access. The question in relation to that, I think, is whether or not then is material suppressed or with limited access, which is properly secret, properly confidential. I don't know the answer to that because I haven't looked at all of the applications that have been made or the suppression orders that have been issued. But it seems to me that that's on the one hand, and that was the Ms. Moss's brief. But what she also says, interestingly, is on the other side of the ledger, and on the other side of the ledger, the audit did not examine how well the media performs or how well journalists adhere to their codes of ethics and codes of conduct. That was not in the audit's brief, but the audit is only too well aware of criticisms of the media for bias or inaccurate reporting. The quality of media performance should be irrelevant to the government's commitment to accountability and openness. So what the report is about is access to information and accountability by government, not accountability by the press. Quite rightly, a different issue.
Rick D'Amelio, then we go over there.
Yes, as you are aware, we have in Australia the family law that protects reporting on issues coming from the court or family issues. Advocate or would like to see in Australia something similar relating to personal privacy protection of reporting and gossip, if you like, or exaggeration of facts that can be avoided through some kind of regulation by the family court.
Effectively, yes. The Family Law Act, to which you refer, is one example of a piece of legislation. It's probably one of the 500 referred
yes.
to Irene Moss's report, which says you either can't get access to information or you can't report it. And that's fine. I don't have an issue with that. What we are saying is that there should be some legislation or development of judge-made law that protects the privacy of individuals. It could be by way of an act, the Privacy Act, or some amendment to the existing Privacy Act. There is a Privacy Act that currently sits out there, and has for a couple of years, but it relates to, for instance, when you provide information to an organisation, what they can and can't do with that information. So one suggestion would be that there should be amendments made to that Act to incorporate the notion of invasion of personal privacy. That would be one way of doing it. So yes, in short, we do think that that will occur because we think it's necessary.
You sound their way. There are two cases that are on the books of privacy. One is the one that we just spoke about, the stress report, and it's still the case. There's another one, which is the ABC Jane Doe in Victoria, and that's presently in the Victorian Court of Appeal. If that goes to the High Court, that may be the way that it involves.
Just so that was a finding at first instance in favour of the plaintiff against the ABC, and it said a number of things, but one of the things it said effectively is that judge said, I think there should be a tort of invasion of privacy, or something very similar to it. The ABC has appealed that, and we think that how that tracks through the courts and let it get settled may be when the High Court gets an opportunity to say we have a tort of invasion of privacy or something similar.
Just before we move on, I mean, you cover family law in your book as well as national security and other issues, but just to look briefly, the Jane Doe case, the circumstances relate to what kind of an alleged invasion of privacy?
Let me try.
Well, just very briefly.
Jane Doe was wrongfully named.
She was a victim of a sexual assault.
Okay.
And then the ABC reported, from memory, the conviction in that case. And on, I think, two occasions, on, I think, radio, they actually named Jane Doe, obviously saying what her real name was. Yeah. Now, that's contrary to a piece of legislation, which is one of those examples of where the media can't publish something. There was a provision which quite rightly said you can't publish the name of someone who's a victim of sexual assault. Now, they breached that and were found, if you like, liable for that. But in that context, one of the things that was pleaded against them, and which the judge found, effectively, was, well, that's also an invasion of a person's privacy.
Okay. There's a question here.
Coming back to the a couple of times you mentioned the so-called double bed between the media and the political government. To what extent do you believe a Bill of Rights could be a way, or should be a way, of capturing a lot of the issues that come here, whether it's privacy, and in both the public arena and also
It would be a sensible way, and it's similar, say, to the American experience, but I don't see it being practically what's going to occur in this country. As I say, I think the right will evolve because of this case law that is bubbling through the system at the moment.
But then we're very limited on a case-by-case basis, right?
Yeah, exactly, and that's one of the problems, if you like, with judge-made law. It will be on a case-by-case basis.
So it'll take 20 years for it to develop, right, nationally, in terms of what is...
Maybe not that long. What will occur? Let's assume, for instance, that this Doe case in the ABC does in fact get to the High Court, double settled along the way. That will be an opportunity for the High Court to say, okay, we're going to embrace the tort of privacy, and we're going to set out in this case what the constituent elements of that tort are. So that would be a way that it would occur. The other way, as I said, would be by legislation. So the parliamentarians could take it upon themselves to say, here's an act, and it's going to say, there's a right to privacy, and these are the elements that there's a breach, someone can enforce their own.
Andrew.
Yes, thank you.
Just
to
follow
up on the
looking at the wrong end of the telescope in a sense. You're talking about how you can define the tort, whatever. However you describe the right which is going to be infringed. But when you look at the reality of the matter, what you're trying to do is to protect your reputation. And it's not going to protect your reputation to get a verdict 3 or 4 years later. Now, Parliament has tried time and time again to make it more available as a remedy, instantaneous or almost instantaneous apology, that is never worked. And the courts have set their face against granting of injunctions to stop the publication of defamatory material. And if you're going to have a right of privacy, how is that going to work in practice? Is there going to be the availability of an injunction to stop the invasion of privacy? If not, then the amount of money you're going to get is not going to be great solace. Now, that's one side of the story. But the other side of the story is the late and somewhat unlamented Robert Maxwell testifies by his career. The gagging orders were equally wrong. And it seems to me that it's all very well to talk about new court of privacy or changing defamation. You've got to, as you said, Peter, at the very beginning, look more at prevention rather than ex post facto compensation. No amount of money is going to restore your reputation. It may help you have a very nice holiday or whatever.
Now, are there any dissents from Justice Rogers' lucid judgment delivered at Clayton Utz today?
No, we agree with that, Andrew. Andrew, I think that's right. It would be wonderful to have a media remedy. Have these days that, one, we've got a general lack of trust of the media, which we see from the research. Two, we've got a diminution of accountability, an erosion of the public interest defence. And that's an environment ripe for the development of some sort of right of privacy. What form that takes, we don't know. I mean, that'll be a matter for the High Court. I agree with you entirely. It would be fantastic if there were a workable, balanced mechanism by means of which some immediate result could be achieved.
Could be
rich.
It's a question here.
What recommendations would you turn organisations and media online?
The question is, what recommendations would you give to an organisation in the media limelight?
That's a really, really important question.
Justice, you're out of order.
there are three or four possibilities. You can sit back and do nothing, and that's probably not a desirable one. You can engage with the media, or you can just go on your own. If you choose to engage in the media, with the media, or if you choose to go alone, it seems to us that you have to get your story straight, first off. So you have to appoint someone who is, in effect, the media relations person, and you have to get your story straight. You have to gather the facts, you have to know what the true situation is. And for goodness sake, the consequence of not getting that, if you issue a press release, for example, which is wrong, and going back and having to correct that would be an utter disaster. So the first thing is get the story straight, get the facts clear. If you want to have any possibility of ultimately having some remedy against the media, it seems to us that you have to make sure that you've given the proper story across, so you have to engage. The reason we say that is perhaps the only slight avenue by means of which you may be able to get some redress is an old remedy called injurious falsehood. I don't really want to go into that now, but it's a very difficult thing to prove, and we're not aware of any contemporary cases where someone successfully sued for injurious falsehood. But it does depend upon the media having the right story. So it seems like you have to do that. If you decide to go alone, that means that you have to issue press releases, take advertisements, put something on the website, notify the ASX notification, whatever it is. That's a path which you should be treading in parallel if you choose to engage with the media. And there are probably all sorts of people in the audience who have had experience and have got some hints in that regard. But it seems to us that the first thing is first, and that's a point of view. Don't let anyone outside that spokesperson speak for the organisation. You
know? The only thing I might add to that is when we talk about engagement, sometimes your only option might actually be trying to engage not with the arm of the media, it's actually putting you in the limelight and it's attacking you, but see whether there's someone else out there in the media who is prepared to listen, maybe with a private briefing as to what your side of the story is, and actually put that message out there. So engagement might be engaging directly with the person attacking you, or it might be by seeking to engage with somebody else.
There are probably two other important things that you should do. If you have a client base and you know that story, then probably might engage your client base and to make sure that the truth facts are out there. I suppose the only other thing is, if there are consequences of a media report, loss of business, complaints from customers, people running in and saying, well, we don't sell our shares in you, or whatever it is, keep a note of that. Those sorts of contemporaneous records are often pretty useful. And if there were an avenue by means of which you could get some sort of progress, that would be very important.
Christine?
It's interesting, you began by mentioning the Richard Pratt case. That, I think, is interesting in that Richard himself, to protect his reputation, self-invaded his privacy by preempting the judgment about the cartel by giving an exclusive interview to a weekend newspaper about his private life. So in that sense, he used the media, it's debatable how effective, but he used the media to try and preserve and protect his reputation, which was about to be smirched. So you're talking a lot about curbing the influence of the media, or the media's powers, or the media's ability to report, sensationalised, and yet is it not more about working more effectively with the media, with whatever powers the media have?
Well, that's my
question. It's not so much curbing the media, it's more effectively managing and working with them.
In one sense, that was an example of a swing in my mind when I was addressing the blatant question here. I think that was an example where Pratt and Biddy knew that this was going to come out in the public. It wasn't going to be that laudatory. So in a sense, let's leave it first. Let's put our spin on what occurs, give our version of the mea culpa, but also importantly, put out there the things about you in your story that are positive. If the story just breaks because the judge hands down a horrendous penalty against you, that other stuff, what you do in the wider society and the donations you make and all the rest of it, that's not going to be part of that story when it breaks through the media. If you put the story out there, and I think that was in a sense that I agree with your point when you said query the extent to which it was successful or not, some people criticised it, but it's a very different strategy, and I think a good example in the sense of the engagement process.
John?
I think just to follow up to that, I think the same thing you said in the visor, as he did exactly the same, where he sort of preempted, kept talking about being Father of the Year. But in your research, I'm really interested if you've made any judgments about the relative standards pertaining to newspaper journalism versus television journalism versus new media. I'm happy to say my own view before you answer that. It seems to me Australia is relatively well served in newspapers. People will have lots of views, but I think the standards in commercial television are just appalling in Australia, and I don't think we are well served by television media, if you call it, people journalists. So I'd be just interested in your view on that.
When we've done Dr. Miller's research, that's strictly looked at general public expectations and media. So this is sharp contrast between members of the media and members of the public. The sort of research that you're talking about has actually been done by the Morgan Group. They looked at general public satisfaction with freedom of TV, radio and newspapers. The other thing they did is they actually broke it down according to particular programs and particular journalists. I am not a statistician and I can't draw any conclusions from any of that. It might be fair to say, and this is just my off-the-cuff unstudied view for what that's worth, but it might be fair to say that some segments of the media suffer as a result of other segments. But that's not a statistician's view, and that's just the cut out of the research very quickly. But that sort of feels like a reasonable conclusion.
Okay, so we're getting to the end now. Question there. Yeah?
I'm interested in your comments on the values that we have as Australians. It seems that many people lie to us, politicians and business people. I wonder whether they really suffer as a result of that. If they're rich enough, they can buy their way out of it by showing a good side or whatever. But you don't really see any people who really lie and then suffer. Now, perhaps they do, I don't know. Do you have any information?
I don't know which seems in fairly high profile jail, isn't it?
A few. But they'll come out and survive, too, probably.
I don't think I can add anything to that.
Right, so can I ask, there's a question down there, is there? Is the question there? No. Okay, and I'll just ask a final question because we're running up to 7 o'clock. You're busy people, and no one makes much money in this country out of writing books. So what's the aim of your book? I mean, you put a lot of work into it across a whole range of areas. Why did you do what you did? Why do you think it's important? So we just start with Norm and end up with Peter, yeah.
So the truthful answer is the genesis of this book was about 7 or 8 years ago. At that time I worked with an associate, so the choice that he made to do it.
Thanks, Mark. That's all very good.
Is there a long answer, or is that's it?
No, the short and long answer was
not. Okay, so Peter must have the long answer. Well, what's the aim of this? Who are you writing it for, essentially, I guess?
We're writing it for a broad group of people. Originally, it was going to be a workbook for journalists and for media students. But as it's evolved, we've seen a need for people to understand what their rights are, what they can do if they've got an issue with their reputation. So it's a working garden. It covers all areas of what you can say, what people can say about you. So in that sense, it's useful. The other thing that has come to us probably in the last 12 to 18 months since it's been finished is the need for us to have for there to be a sensible debate about the issues that we've raised tonight. I mean, we're being in part provocative. We've raised this research about the media, knowing full well that it may or not be happily received. The only run that we've seen for the research was on the Radio National program. There may be others. I haven't really Googled to find out. But it's probably an unpopular message. That having been said, we think from the perspective of the individual who is aggrieved, and that's all of us who may be pilloried from time to time, it's important to know that we have some sort of protection of our rights. If we accept that we don't have any rights which require protection, that's fine. As a society, we live with that. But I don't think we necessarily accept that.
Many thanks. As I said, copies of Reputation Matters, if CCH has them here tonight. I found it an extremely useful book. I mean, I just wanted to just check out the defamation changes that came into effect, I think, on the 1st of January 2006, where the joint defamation law that now exists in Australia between the federal, state and territory jurisdictions. And it's all there in one page. And I think you've done a great job across a whole range of issues. I think you have been controversial tonight, and that's what the Sydney Institute's all about. And that's great. But I think what's also important, your book contains a huge amount of information, and people of all sorts of views can read it and learn from it and argue about it, whether or not they agree with your central thesis, which I guess is what scholarship is all about. So thanks for stimulating discussion tonight. Congratulations on your book. And no doubt we'll have you back at the Institute sometime in the future to check out developments. But for tonight, thank you.
Well done, Peter.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.